Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the South Dakota State Capitol building in Pierre, and we have 2 hours of coverage with leaders and lawmakers here in the state capitol. Sitting across from me now, Governor Kristi Noem. Governor Noem, thank you for stopping by.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me on the program.
So I thought we'd go through today a little bit of the state of the state, expand on some of the issues that were important to you. And let's begin at the beginning with this notion of really the opportunities you've had to listen not only to folks in Pierre, but folks across the state, and some of the things they're telling you about families just trying to get ahead, families, you know, worried about things, lots of good things happening in the state, but some anxiety as well.
Yeah, we do. We've had great leadership in the state of South Dakota, and very grateful to Governor Dennis Dugard for the fiscal soundness that the state is in because of decisions that he and his leadership team and the legislature have made. But we do have challenges ahead. And so that really was the message I wanted to carry in the State of the State address, was celebrate the things that are going well, but not look away from some of our biggest challenges that we have. I started the speech by talking about the fact that we need broadband across the state, that really it's very difficult to get economic development to help families be prosperous if they don't even have basic internet service. And what is surprising to a lot of people in the state is that it's not even necessarily our most rural areas. You know, I named several counties that are pretty populated with significant towns that just don't have good internet service in many areas. So this is a focus that we're going to have. It's expensive. So it's going to take the state partnering with private companies and telecom and other industries to make it happen. But we have to start working on it now, because if we want to be a state that really does continue to grow and be prosperous, we have to recruit those businesses here that really rely on technology. And even, you know, small little mom and pop shops on Main Street, they need internet access in order to do their business as well.
One of the things, and the way you phrased it in the address, was this notion that there are people who think, you know, maybe it's too expensive, maybe it doesn't matter. And, you know, you address that from an economic perspective and from, you know, kids who want to come back and live, you know, or farmers who want, you know, another family member to have a business. But it also struck me that there's this sense that if you don't move forward on this, it's almost like a whole group of people don't exist, matter. It's bigger than just some of these important examples.
And I've been told by those in the industry and other folks that it's too expensive, we can't do it. And that's what's holding us back right now, is that it will be challenging, and we'll have to be innovative, and we'll have to use new technologies to really get internet access to individuals. But we have sons and daughters and families all over this country that are tired of the rat race. They're tired of congestion and traffic and living that life, and our quality of life is so wonderful. Why not provide what is necessary for them to come home and be with their families and enjoy the quality of life that we have here in South Dakota? So it's not something that we're going to complete in this first year, and I'm well aware of that, but we're going to start aggressively towards the goal of getting that connection and high-speed internet access, because it really is the key to our success in the future.
Is there anything in the new Farm Bill or in your relationship with Senator John Thune that sort of helps make this door open a little wider?
You know, Senator Thune is in a perfect position, and his being the chairman previously of the Commerce Committee is well aware of the challenges that we have. And we have other states that are running programs that are working very well. One of the states we're looking at is Minnesota, where they state dollars partner with private dollars and makes that bridge go even farther and brings in other entities that are interested in trying new technologies. And we are a nimble state. We're small. That means that we can do things that other states can't do. And that makes it exciting for them to come here and try pilot projects and to try new experiences. So we're recruiting them as well. But working with the federal government to do that and getting on the agenda of those companies is incredibly important. And, you know, the last 8 years, I've had the chance to build some of those relationships with folks and know the challenges that we do have and where they are in South Dakota. If we just connect the dots and the state is willing to partner, I think we can make some big strides.
That was a theme throughout your speech, and you said several times, you know, we're going to do this, whatever this would be, without raising taxes.
Right.
And then you would, you know, use examples of you know, regular citizens from South Dakota providing the next new idea or partnerships with federal government, partnerships with industry. When you place it like that? Do you think that there's a room for people to really, do you think people tend to kind of think about where's the money come from and then go right to taxes? And you're trying to get them to think more broadly about possibilities there?
I think that's an easy fallback position, is people think, well, we're going to have to raise taxes to do that. But that doesn't really give people a lot of ownership in being part of the solution, too. And it doesn't bring people to the table that really do have the experience to provide that type of a service. So when we build partnerships, I talked about the meth epidemic, which is something that we have to hit head on, that's impacting families, impacting the next generation in big ways, and really hurting and it's costing us more money in law enforcement treatment, and how we have to change the way we do that. If we don't partner with private industries, if we don't partner with foundations or nonprofits that work in this space, and if we didn't partner with maybe ministries that are willing to help in this area, I don't think we have as good of results, and we don't have long-lasting effects, because you can't just put somebody, if they're on meth, into a 30-day treatment program and then release them and expect everything to be okay. A meth is highly addictive. It takes a long time to get your brain back and rewired after being on meth so that you don't feel constantly driven by that addiction. And so we need to have foundations and nonprofits that specialize in counseling, ministries that will help mentor that family and get them through that difficult time and walk alongside them and encourage them. And when we bring everybody to that table is when we're going to see big changes. So that's why I don't always want to just say the state needs to pay for this, we raise taxes. You get much better results when you get everybody a part of the solution.
Let's talk about meth a little bit, because you focused on prevention and treatment. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you said specifically was this notion of reaching somebody before they're mm-hmm. part of the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, Attorney General Jason Roundsburg will be here in a little while. Mm-hmm. There's this notion of messaging and telling people there's, you know, no tolerance and we won't have dealers here. So there's different, you know, ways that people are going to access the information about, you know, if this is a problem in my family, what do I do about it?
Yeah.
How do you overcome the sense that somebody who has an issue needs to seek help, mm-hmm. but yet they're also afraid
of the penalties
of coming
that come
forward
with it.
And saying, yeah. this is happening in my house?
Yeah. And that does happen quite a bit, where people say, you know, we have someone that has an addiction, but will we have criminal charges, or will there right. be something? And then the kids get removed from the home and the right. family gets separated. You know, that's a huge change as well. So a lot of times the national news is talking about opioids, and that is an issue in South Dakota. We do have an opioid issue, but our vast majority of addiction issues happen with meth still. There are bills that I worked on at the federal level that give resources and dollars to states to fight opioids. I'm going to be trying to get some leeway from those federal agencies to use those dollars for meth, because it's such a bigger issue here in South Dakota. Now, on the East Coast, many of those states, their big issue is opioids, and that's those bills are written in a way that they can utilize those funds right away. I can't necessarily take those dollars and utilize them for meth today, but that's what I'm going to be asking for waivers on. But the prevention is very impactful. In fact, we used to get federal grants to do prevention in our schools, and we saw a dramatic change in the age of first use. I think at one time it was 11, 12 years old we're using. After we were doing prevention efforts, we moved that average age up to 14, 15 years old. So we knew it made a difference. If we can do that again, and the state will have to put some skin in the game to make sure we have prevention dollars, but do it in very effective ways that translate to kids what the real effects of meth are. And I was a little graphic in some of my descriptions yesterday, but I think a lot of people in the state, when they think about addiction and meth, they think, well, that's happening in downtown cities. It's happening far away from my family. They don't realize it's happening in small towns, that it's happening right. possibly next door. And that when you use stories like that, it makes people realize the horrors that are going on inside these houses and what our law enforcement officers have to deal with and why we can't look away and ignore it. So that's why prevention's incredibly important. I've talked to law enforcement officers all across this state that say it is nothing anymore for us to run across a child that's 8 or 9 years old that's an alcoholic. It is nothing for us to see 12-year-olds now that are on meth. And, you know, those kids don't have supervision at home. They don't have strong families. There's no accountability, and there's no help. I had one psychiatrist tell me a story about a young girl that was 11 years old that was having issues at school, beating up other children. She had other things going on in her family, but he said she she also was torturing the family pets at home. But he said, I have nowhere in this state where I can send an 11-year-old for the kind of in-treatment counseling that she needed. He said, that's the kind of services that we need to have. What can we do to have family counseling ahead of time to educate our kids and do prevention? But then also, what kind of treatment do we have available for those, because they're becoming addicted and having issues younger and younger?
Right. When the state closed just recently the Star Academy mm-hmm. and said, you know, these services need to be offered closer to home, mm-hmm. There was some, you know, thoughts that there weren't enough services offered closer mm-hmm. to home, and that there would be a gap in what some of those kids needed, but no longer had access to
yeah.
because the Star Academy didn't exist.
Well, and I think if you're in, you know, families have told me and that if they're in Sioux Falls, they can find services. There are services in Rapid City, although not enough. But if you're in Huron, or if you're in Britton, or if you're in Faith, South Dakota, what do I do if I have someone who's facing addiction? What do I do if I have someone that needs counseling? Or there just isn't. And a lot of small communities have started to form task forces. They've started to get law enforcement, healthcare providers, counselors to the table, and community leaders to have a group of individuals that are proactively dealing with it. But I would like to have it where we are, there's a blueprint and support for all of these communities to where we make sure that those services are available close to home. Because you can't take someone and put them in treatment for 30 to 60 days and then send them right back home into the situation that they were in. They will revert more than likely back to their previous behaviors. So if you can do family counseling, and if you can bring others to the table that are in their life that they'll be spending time with and change that entire dynamic, you have much better results and much better long-lasting change.
We know you were part of the conversations before Governor Dennis Dugard announced his budget proposal mm-hmm. for the year. When do we see Governor Noem's budget proposal?
It will be coming out shortly. There is a state law that says it has to be out by the 10th day of legislative session. So we are working on that budget right now. And it was very helpful for Governor Dennis Dugard to bring us into his discussion. So we've already had the advantage of hearing those departments and agencies talk about why they're requesting more funds in this area, hear him talk about why his budget looked the way that it did, and hear that debate. And I was able to ask questions too, which was great. So we're pretty far down the road, and we'll pull that together, and then it'll look different. But I think that a lot of them will still see some of the same themes and priorities, because I really do appreciate the decisions that Governor Dugard has made over the years. But I do think that I'll have some other priorities that I'll be looking at as well.
Speaking of former governors, you mentioned former Governor Bill Janklow in his efforts to bring the credit card industry to mm-hmm. South Dakota. Let's talk about the next big thing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are excited about even calling it that.
That's true.
And, you know, you listed some examples of cybersecurity and human health research and value-added ag. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about the process, you know, with you know, what were some of the things that sort of helped, you know, places like Citibank come to the state, mm-hmm. and how do you sort of structure the next big thing?
Yeah, I think it's having the vision to go get it. And that's exactly what Governor Janklow did back then in the 80s, was that he became aware that these companies, these financial services, were looking for a place to be that was business friendly, where they had a workforce that knew how to work hard and good quality of life like South Dakota. And they went out and did it. They revamped state laws to make this a perfect place for those types of companies. And that's what we need to be aggressive on doing again. I think we have unique opportunities with cybersecurity. With DSU there, and the advantages that they have with training a lot of cybersecurity individuals already. They're already doing training for our NSA employees, which are federal employees that go on and do our security systems for the federal government. They have built a SCIF, which is a secure facility, which allows us to do a lot of stuff I can't talk about.
Right.
but that's a huge advantage for us to have. In fact, I was with a group of folks that were in the cybersecurity and DOD contractor space several months ago, and I've told this story many times, that they started talking about the threats that they face. They get a lot of people hacking into their systems. They were in Florida, and they said that ships and subs will come up offshore and conduct surveillance on their companies trying to break into their systems. Also with high buildings there in Miami, they were putting equipment up that was able to conduct surveillance on them. They were concerned about that. And then with high population and high frequencies and different types of equipment in the area. They were challenged by that. And I drove home to all of those executives and DOD contractor folks that, listen, we don't have any of those challenges in South Dakota. We don't have coastlines that ships and subs can come up. We're not heavily populated, and we don't have a lot of tall buildings. We are the perfect place for those types of companies, that they can be much more secured. Personal information, our federal government information, our Department of Defense information could be handled securely here in our state. We just need to go there and tell our story. During the inauguration weekend, Congressman Kevin McCarthy was here from California, and we were talking about my vision for a lot of cybersecurity and technology opportunities that we have. He said, you need to come to California. I said, our companies out there are looking for places to go where they can afford to even function. You know, we're taxing everybody in California so much. The regulations are killing those companies. They're looking for other places to locate, and South Dakota would be perfect. So we just need to go there and be talking to those companies and let them know about the advantages that we have right here in South Dakota.
Which is a perfect transition into a trained workforce. Mm-hmm. And do we have the infrastructure? Do we have the people to support the next big thing economically? Education, and how do we get there? What are some of those steps?
Well, I think that focusing on education is incredibly important, preparing our next generation for what, being prepared for those careers here at home, working on not just the K-12 system, which we talked a little bit about, civics education and the citizenship test, making sure that we know our history is incredibly important so we aren't doomed to repeat history as well. But then our K-12, beyond that, our technical schools, putting CTE classes in, giving kids the opportunity to experience the workforce, and then working with our regions to continue to do what they do best. Most of our kids are going through those institutions to prepare for their careers. And really, every one of the things I talked about in the State of the State was that every single child is what should be in the forefront of our mind when we're looking at every policy. Because if we're not preparing this state for the next generation, then we're doing a grave disservice to them.
As a parent, when I heard you talk about civics education, I wanted to ask you about, I have a daughter in the school system. Mm-hmm. She's in government. Mm-hmm. She's in history. Is there a gap, an absence from the kids having that information? Because it doesn't seem like something, I mean, she might not know exactly what's on the citizenship test, but it doesn't seem like it would be a big jump based on her history education and her U.S. government education.
Yeah. I think it depends on which school district you're in.
Okay.
How much time a student actually spends learning civics, how much time they actually spend government. There usually typically is a government class that's required, but not necessarily the civics background and the basic fundamentals of government. So what we're talking about is making it a graduation requirement.
Right. Yep. So she was telling me last night about, you know, the Establishment Clause and federalism.
Oh,
and,
good for her.
And, you know, they went through the election.
I love it.
So it seemed like that was a pretty rigorous, something
so
in existence.
I had an individual tell me yesterday in the hallway that their daughter had come home the week before, and the teacher had asked them to explain if anybody in the room knew what the Electoral College was, and there was only one student in a room of about 40 students that knew even what the Electoral College was and what they had heard of before. So, and that those were juniors and seniors. So I think that it is depends on the school district and the teacher, and but that citizenship test is incredibly challenging. We were talking about who all had taken it. And I said to the group, I said, I need to go take it.
Right.
But I know that those who do take it, the immigrants that come to South Dakota, come to our country that do take that test, say that it's something they study for a long period of time. And one of the best stories was a young man who came running up to me in Sioux Falls one day and said, Christy, I know who you are. But he said, I just became a citizen a month ago. And he was so excited. But he knew more about our government, its foundations, the branches, the accountability, who his leaders were, who was in office, than I would say the vast majority of people that, I mean, he was rattling off everything he learned on there. And what a gift to him to start in this new country. And he recognized what an honor it was to be an American as well.
And talk about how it expands beyond the sense of, a graduation requirement or an understanding of the foundation of Americans. But it also, it creates an engaged citizenry Someone stopped by the STPB studios yesterday asking, how do I, they were watching you on the television during the State of the State and wanting to, you know, what does the Legislative Research Council do? Asking real questions about how to follow a bill. So the more education you get, then actually you're, it's not just a test to move on to. It's an opportunity to help them be engaged in their state government as well.
Yeah, I think so too. It's raising awareness. And, you know, this is, I think a lot of folks maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe didn't necessarily know there was a citizenship test. Or if we're talking about it, and if kids are taking it, it might inspire their parents. It starts more of those conversations. I don't think that's a bad thing.
Does it increase respect for immigrants themselves and what they go through to become Americans from folks who maybe haven't really thought, you know, that the person next to you, you know, might know more about government than you do right now?
That's exactly one of my points of pushing this, is because people don't know what they go through to become citizens in this. And they're so happy to be here. And it takes them years to become citizens legally, which I think that needs to be fixed. It shouldn't be that hard to go through that process. But they consider it a huge honor to do that. And I think that if they can do that, as someone who's struggling to learn a language, as someone who's struggling to adapt to a new home, a new culture, if they can go through that process, we as Americans who were born here, maybe we should be thinking about doing those things too.
Tell us a little bit about your goals for transparency. And specifically, you said, I want a bill to sign about a reporter shield law. Why is that important to you?
Because I believe that the free and independent press is incredibly important. And I don't want reporters to feel as though when they're doing their investigative work that they could possibly be subpoenaed to come before a court, that they might be forced to give up their sources. That is something that I've been told has happened before, that they felt that challenged, that potentially they were concerned they would have to reveal sources when they were trying to do some real digging into an issue that was going on. And I just think it's basic government and protections that we should have in place to make sure that we have investigative reporters that are able to go out there and do their job without fear of retaliation or being dragged in front of a court.
Is it important at this time to build trust in state government for those who have lost it?
Yeah, absolutely. I heard it over the last several years. I certainly heard it out on the campaign trail over and over again. We have a lot of things in this state that we do to be transparent, but we can do better. And I want people to trust state government, know that it has integrity, and whatever we can do to help that, I think, is very, very important. Everything that the state government does is funded by taxpayer dollars, and that's money that comes out of people's pockets in our state that work very hard to earn that money. You know, we have the highest rate of working moms in the nation in South Dakota, and that's largely because people don't have big incomes in South Dakota. It usually takes two people in a household to pay the bills. The average family of four only makes about $54,000 a year in this state. And so if people work hard for their money and they're raising kids here, then let's respect them enough to let them know how the state government is spending it and what they're doing.